From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 650, Controlling Cloud Costs with guest Corey Quinn, recorded Monday, July 22nd, 2019. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts LLC. For more information, visit soundthoughtsllc.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio, bringing on a fellow IT podcaster today, Corey Quinn, who is a cloud economist at the Duckbill Group. Corey specializes in helping companies improve their AWS bills by making them smaller and less horrifying. He hosts the Screaming in the Cloud and the AWS Morning Brief podcast and curates Last Week in AWS, a weekly newsletter summarizing the latest in AWS news, blogs, and tools sprinkled with snark. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure to once again hear the sound of my own voice, in this case, when talking to you.
We do must like our voices for making as many podcasts as we do between us.
I'm told that I have a voice for radio, which is awesome because I also have a face for radio.
Okay. So you're going to go there.
Together.
Yeah. You've got the snark for radio, sir. You do that better than most.
Well, thank you. To be very honest with you, the reason that I have a second podcast is when you do an interview show with a different guest every week, you can't be the all snarky, all sarcastic, creature that I've become.
Mm-hmm.
Because as soon as you have a guest who doesn't, perform in the same way,
sure,
it looks like you're beating the crap out of your guest.
Yeah. No, it's absolutely a problem.
Yeah, it's a way you can do a show. But as soon as someone hears it and it looks bad, you're never getting another guest again.
Yeah.
So you have to draw a line somewhere.
Well, and there's some guests that, you know, they are friends and people know it. And so it's just teasing a friend. But not all guests are like that, nor should they be. And yeah, you have to be careful. So you've made new shows now just so you have more room for snark?
Indeed. It started off as a weird, confliction of two specific issues. One, I wanted a show where I could have a bit more of just me, just the personality, mm-hmm, and not have to worry about inadvertently making someone look bad. But there was also a sort of a happy accident where I was talking to a company that wanted to sponsor some of the stuff I was working on to promote something in the near term. And that's great. But at the time, everything I had was booked out for almost 3 months and they had given me 3 weeks. And their counterpoint was, well, we have money. What can we do with money?
And we'd like to give some of it to you.
Exactly. I'm a consultant. So my immediate response is, you have money. Why didn't you say so? And part of that was an idea I'd been kicking around for a long time. So we launched the AWS Morning Brief, mm-hmm, which was an idea I'd been kicking around for a couple of months and then took it from vague idea to recording the first episode in a couple of hours.
Right.
And pro tip, don't do that if you can possibly avoid it. I'm looking back now and sort of facepalming at a few of the early mistakes I made with that. But that's the nice thing about a podcast. You can evolve it. You can,
sure,
find a voice for a show. And no one ever really expects much in the first dozen or so.
Yeah, I've come to appreciate when launching new shows, I've done that a few times, is that before you publish one, you should record a dozen or so. And you're going to shake a lot of that stuff out just by the practice.
Exactly. And that's what would have been the better approach.
Mm-hmm.
The counterpoint is because it's listing off the announcements from the past week,
right,
that AWS has done, at least in its current form. Well, that becomes a bit of a problem.
Yeah, it's going to take you a few weeks to do
them. I can't exactly record it in advance for 3 episodes and go on vacation.
Right.
And I can't really do it piecemeal either. It sounds like it's choppy as heck with different audio environments at both times. So I sort of have a very narrow window during which I can intelligently record these things. And then every weekend is a fire drill for my poor audio engineer.
Of course. See, now you're trapped in that absolute routine. How did you get into this business? What's the Corey Quinn origin story? Because I got to imagine at one point you had a normal job. How did you end up in the consulting practice for around AWS bills?
Terrific question. About 3 years ago, I figured, well, I'm just going to tell people that I'm good at this thing. And when you're an overdressed, mediocre white man in tech, no one generally questions you because our industry is terrible across the board, start to finish. But again, my failure mode was more or less a book deal at that point.
Right.
And it's one of those areas that first, no one wants to be an expert in. And two, I'd been dabbling with it enough that I thought I knew enough to call myself one. Spoiler, I did not. I have learned so much in the past 3 years that I just didn't see coming. But it really came out of an idea of wanting to start a business, not because I had this grand idea for, I guess, a new way of approaching cloud economics, but rather because I had been an employee repeatedly, and I'm terrible at it. The reason I run a company is because, honestly, I'm not suited for anything else.
You wouldn't hire you?
No one should hire me. And I find it flattering, incidentally, that a majority of my clients so far have at least made overtures, if not outright offers, about coming to work for them full time. But the things that make me excel as a consultant make me terrible as an employee.
Interesting.
Well, on the plus side, I know this about myself.
But also, if you're tuning people's bills, isn't that a short duration task? How long does it take to sort of analyze how people are using AWS and figure out some cost-cutting opportunities?
Great question. It turns out that it's a backdoor into cloud governance, two words that everyone hates. So if you start trying to pitch that up front, people's eyes glaze over and no one wants to talk to you,
right,
particularly if you're wearing a suit, as is my general approach to life. So talking about fixing the bill, you're right. That's extremely short duration as far as finding the misconfigurations, the low-hanging fruit. And then it turns into building a cadence, building a governance strategy to make sure that they don't wind up in this situation again. How to structure that intelligently is something that I weigh in on. But on a month-to-month cadence and keeping tabs on things, that begins to look a lot more like an accounting function than it does a consulting function.
Interesting.
And yeah, I do have long-term customers who I help with those things when it makes sense to do so. But past a certain point, having a team to handle these things absolutely makes sense. It's just hard to justify that until you hit a certain level of spend.
Yeah, isn't that actually just a role for an IT person ultimately to be responsible for that governance?
Sort of. But it generally also needs to have deep insight into finance and how they care about these things, or at least be able to speak the language.
Sure.
Plus an intelligent comprehension of the strategic objectives of the business, because very often that's going to dictate what you do next and how. It comes down to a culture problem much more than it does a technical one in short order.
And what sort of problems are you talking about? Are people just over-provisioning? Is that usually where they're wasting money?
That's part of it. I mean, again, they say that the cloud is not costing you what you use. It's costing you what you forget to turn off. And there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, I bet.
Because turning things off is scary, especially when you couple that with a terrible governance process where it used to take us 6 weeks to get a server provision. So now with cloud, we're going to have one person wind up acting as the gatekeeper, and we can get that out in only 4 short weeks. People will ask every 20 minutes until you spin something up,
right,
but they're not going to ask you to turn it off, especially if they have to go through a process to get it turned back on.
And I got to
think they're going to keep it around just in case.
And I got to think that every day that goes by that it's still up, you're more afraid to turn it off.
Absolutely, because it wouldn't be there if it wasn't important, would it?
Right. Yeah. No, I've certainly in the early days of the Azure cloud, as somebody who's always worked closely with Microsoft, and they would give us some credits so we could play with things, but you would burn out those credits in a few days if you didn't remember to turn things off. So my first experiences with Azure were finding out you really need to remember to shut that stuff off.
Absolutely. My first experience with Azure was earlier this year. And one of the things that made that work super well was I didn't have to even give a credit card number. It was at build,
yeah,
where I'm sitting there spinning something up and waiting for the keynote to start. And because I am incredibly unfortunate is probably the best way to put this, I immediately hit a provisioning bug that it turned out was an underlying storage issue in the region I'd randomly picked. And I'm not blaming Azure for this. It's computers. They break. It's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
But diagnosing that was a little on the interesting side. And again, I didn't log back into it. And then I got an escalatingly frantic series of emails that, hey, if you don't give us a credit card, we're going to turn this thing that you've logged into once off. Great. That's fine. You can do that. But I like that approach much better than I do, for example, AWS's model of, yeah, we're going to charge you 22 cents in perpetuity. Good luck. Have fun. That's just the tax for going about your business.
Which, you know, the kinds of companies that do that are like the fitness clubs you can't cancel and the JConnects of the world. Like, I would not think that cloud providers want to be in that club.
No, I would absolutely not. And hell, one of the things that I love about GCP is you can click on a project and terminate all billable resources in that project. When you're doing something similar on AWS, okay, turn off everything that's billing me in this account. Well, you'd better pack a lunch because you're going on safari.
Wow, that's really cool. I like the context that GCP puts that in, right? That it's specific to the thing you're working in. I'll just turn off that stuff.
oh, GCP's technology is fantastic, and the way they're presenting it for the developer experience is spot on. Where they're sort of getting lost in the weeds is that, generally speaking, developers are not signing $120 million a year contracts most companies more than once, because the first time they find out you did that, you don't work there anymore, and the police would have some inquiries they'd like to make. It comes down to understanding not just who the customer is, but who the buyer is going to be. Mm-hmm. These are complex enterprise sales, and I think the Thomas Kurian is a terrific pick to start fixing some of that. The question is whether he'll be permitted to do so.
Interesting.
Looking forward to seeing either way.
Yeah, isn't it funny how the cloud products reflect the companies that they're from? Of course, Google's oriented towards the developer. That's just how they think. They have always thought. And of course, AWS has always had an eye. They led with infrastructure for a reason. They're warehousers and retailers. They think that way.
Absolutely. What I don't understand, it is borderline unconscionable to me, is how they were allowed to evolve almost completely without competition mm-hmm. for, what was it, 5 years?
Something like that. They talk about a mulligan. I mean, they basically restarted AWS once before anybody showed up.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I like AWS. Mm-hmm. I use AWS, but I'm not a partisan. I want to see them do well, but I don't want to see an Amazon monoculture where using anything else becomes borderline irresponsible.
Yeah.
I want to see Azure do well. I want to see GCP thrive. I want to see Oracle driven out of business and into the sea. But there's not going to be, I guess, anything good that happens for customers if AWS just takes it as a runaway hit and everyone runs things there.
Sure.
If I thought that were the best answer, I'd probably work there instead of working independently.
Well, and I also think that the competition of the cloud is not just the race for the floor for the lowest possible price. That the feature sets matter, and how you interact with the software matters. That's why I got thrilled by your description of GCP's ability to manage bills. It's just like that's super useful for the customer, and perhaps less useful for the vendor.
There seems to be a misunderstanding that in many large scale environments that when people sit down to figure out which vendor they're going to go with, well, first they're going to draw up an apples to apples comparison. And we're going to see how much this container would cost to run on each of these environments in each of these different regions. And here in reality, no one does that.
Mm-hmm.
They will absolutely use that as a component to negotiate with the provider they're already going to pick.
Right.
But it's a capability story. It's a strategic business story. Heck, Amazon has some compelling reasons not to do business with them. They compete with everyone. There's a strong sense that they may be too big to fail in some respects, which mm-hmm. I don't disagree with. And at some point, you don't necessarily want to be giving money directly to your competitors.
Right.
As a counterpoint, you also have to look at what skill set do you already have. If you're all in on AWS today and you've staffed accordingly, and today you're going to roll out onto Azure instead, well, people have a choice. Do they learn a second cloud from scratch, or do they take their incredibly valuable skill set down the street and start working somewhere else instead that'll pay them more money?
Right.
It's not lock-in so much as it is buy-in.
Do you find that that people feel like they're only skilled in one of the cloud platforms, that they're different enough that you don't feel like you can carry your skills elsewhere?
I can name maybe a dozen people who are not in that case, and that's about it.
Right.
Again, I can stumble my way through the console in any of these providers because most of the time they've given at least a hat tip to accessibility and being understandable.
Right.
But I certainly don't have anything approaching the deep insider knowledge that I do of AWS to any other provider. Now, if that changes down the road and Azure becomes a breakout success, I can learn what they're doing faster than they can drive AWS into irrelevance.
Sure.
But today, I just don't see the same level of expensive problem that I do in the AWS universe.
Mm-hmm. Well, and do you think that's specific to AWS per se, or is it just that that's the space you're in, more people are implementing over there, so there's more mistakes being made?
Good question. I think that, well, for starters, let's give this some context here. My customers now spend over $1 billion a year on cloud computing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're, with remarkably few exceptions, it's all on AWS, where that's where people have built things. That's where things tend to live. And the reasons that they have bill challenges are not necessarily that they've done anything wrong. And it's not that they're ignorant, far from it. But when you're building something, you're not trying to do it for the least possible amount of money.
Right.
That's what someone who's never going to launch tends to do. You want to be borderline responsible, but you can always go back and fix it.
Yeah.
It's just a different form of technical debt to some extent.
To go back, yeah. So I think the instinct to over-provision so that resource constraints aren't why your application struggling makes a lot of sense. It's just nobody gets around to going and turning the knobs back down.
Sort of. But you also see other aspects too, where you have a company that's spending a few hundred million a year on AWS, for example, and then they sit down, it's time to do the monthly purchase of reserved instances. That's an $18 or $22 or $30 million check, depending on what you're seeing at a given point in time. That's a gut check to sign that. Right. And effectively, it's one of those, for most of us, more than we'll ever make in a lifetime. Who's going to sign off on something like that? Because heaven forbid they're wrong. It's scary. So people don't. They punt. And it tends to be the wrong approach, because when you're committed at that scale, you're going to spend it one way or another. May as well do it at a discount. So having someone third party who is completely objective, and I do consider myself objective in this sense, is often extremely valuable.
It's them covering their own butts too. So like, I hired the pro and he says this is reasonable.
Exactly. And worst case, if someone says it still feels high, great. Cut it by 20%, then make the purchase, then see where you land next month.
Sure.
It's not one of those things where these are one-way doors, where you've absolutely got to make these decisions.
Well, one would argue you don't even have to wait the month, right? You can see it day over day and see what software is struggling or what features aren't working and what your burn rate is.
Absolutely. And plus, at that scale, the rules don't apply in quite the same way. If you were to purchase a bunch of the wrong reserved instances, for example, and you spent $1,000 you didn't have to, you've got an uphill battle to get that purchase unwound.
Right.
When you're spending that level of effectively a phone number every month and you make the wrong purchase, you call your account manager and things just sort of happen appropriately, because no one wants to drive ill will among their customer base of, ha-ha, we tricked them into overspending that quarter. I'm sure that won't come back to bite us next quarter. It doesn't work that way. You've got to treat people like you'd want to be treated yourself.
Sure. And these are long-term relationships.
Very much so.
Corey, I'm going to interrupt for one moment for this very important message. Every year on Black Friday, you see the same sales on the same TVs and SSDs. This year, why not get your company to buy you something you actually want? At BrentOzar.com/Black Friday, you can sign up for early access to deep discounts on SQL Server and Azure SQL DB training. That's BrentOzar.com/Black Friday. And then maybe you can watch that training on your new TV. And we're back. It's Run As Radio. I'm Richard Campbell. That's Corey Quinn. Yeah, that's right. Two podcasters on a show at the same time. It's a battle over the better microphone. And talk a little bit about the return on investment of cloud. Because, you know, when you're thinking about $30 million worth of reserved instances, what is the price of that if you were running it as your own infrastructure? Do you have anybody at the scale now where they still wonder, shouldn't we just be building our own cloud?
I think everyone at almost every scale asks themselves that question.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. I mean, the public example that I've made a number of references to has been Lyft. Mm-hmm. And everything I've said has been based purely on what is publicly known about their environment. We know that they are committed to spend a minimum of $100 million a year on AWS. And half the internet loves to go and point fun at that and say, oh, we're automatically going to be able to save money if we can just migrate that to something on-prem. Well, sort of. If you take a look at what their spend is going towards and what they're doing with AWS, and they've told us there are multiple case studies of how Lyft is using AWS available on the AWS website. It's not just a bunch of VMs running somewhere and some disk and some network. There's a lot of other things that go into that. You also, even if it were, which again, most modern infrastructures are not, there's something to consider as far as you don't have to staff up to manage these things.
Right.
It turns out that building and running a data center or even a colo requires stupendous amounts of effort to run those at significant scale. You have to hire a team of people whose sole job it is to go around and replace hard drives or the equivalent.
Yes.
And when there's a networking issue or a power issue, AWS and the other hyperscale cloud providers all have hired larger teams than your company who are among the best in the world at solving these problems at significant scale. So when we take a look at this, what are you really gaining? What are you buying? And part of it is, oh, we don't want to be locked in. Well, sorry, you're locked in anyway, whether you want to be or not.
Yeah.
You take a look at Dropbox, publicly claimed that they saved $74 million by moving off of S3 and into their own data centers for storage. Well, maybe that was the right answer. Maybe it wasn't. How are you calculating out those costs? The fun thing about data centers is you can amortize their spend over a significant period of time. AWS does this themselves. They don't even buy them outright. They do capital leases, which reflects very differently on the balance sheet.
Sure.
And that's how their free cash flow remains as high as it does. There's a lot of interesting financial engineering that goes into these things. But then if you're going to do the Dropbox approach, you've got to be able to effectively rebuild a storage service that's replicated multi-site, redundant paths. The durability has to be incredibly high given the nature of what it is. The latency has to be right there. Mistakes are absolutely going to be recognized by your customer base in short order. I'm not saying they were wrong to do it, but it was a tremendous engineering effort no matter how you slice it.
Well, I'm going to fall firmly on the team side of things. I know what it takes to build a team that good. It'll probably take you a year to hire everybody and more than another year to get them working well enough together that you can trust them.
Completely. And that's something else that I think people are taking way too lightly about the JEDI contract. At the time of this recording, it has not been awarded, but it's down to Azure and AWS as far as who's going to get the Pentagon's $10 billion over 10-year project. And what no one seems to be paying attention to is regardless of who wins on that, suddenly the market for people with cloud computing skill sets and who hold or can hold a clearance is going to go sky high.
Yeah.
We're going to see an exodus coming from public sector. Suddenly the contractors who have been serving the government for a very long time are going to have significant retention challenges. And we're about to see a massive inflection. Right now, if I were a clearance holder in the general DC area or willing to relocate wherever they're going to build this thing, and I had cloud computing skill sets, I'd start quietly pricing out boats.
Because you're going to have some opportunities. Actually, I want to jump back a little to that whole Dropbox thing, because I also, maybe this is my cynicism showing up. I wonder why they wrote that blog post, because I don't think it was to crow about how cool they were. I got to think they were in negotiations with AWS for a better rate, as I'm sure Lyft is too, you know.
To be clear, every single large-scale environment has negotiated something with AWS. They're clear on this publicly as far as what they do.
Right.
Where there are enterprise agreements available more or less for the asking. Those tend to be $0 contracts. Mm-hmm. And then there's an enterprise discount program addendum to that, which historically have not been made public. But there are some that are public record now, so we can talk about them. They tend to be generally templated out. They tend to be aligned with customer's usage and continuing to predict. And it's more or less a commitment to spend a certain amount of money over a period of time. The exact format of that and the dollar figures, of course, vary. But in return for that, there's some kind of flat rate across the board discount in most cases. Occasionally, there are special treatment given. But yeah, when you're spending $100 million a year, spoiler, no one's paying list price for anything.
Right.
It doesn't matter what you're buying.
But it's so that sort of brings me back to, what is it the average consumer or the average IT person consuming cloud on the behalf of their organization supposed to do to optimize? Is it just making sure the unimportant instances are turned off? Is that the bulk of it?
Depends who they are. It depends on the overall approach. I mean, I had a phone call with someone who was incensed that their development and their engineering group was spending, what was it? It was something on the order of $80,000 a month.
Right.
They said it should have been $40,000 a month. Okay, tell me more. How many engineers are we talking? 50. Okay, what do you folks do? We're a subsidiary of a much larger company figuring out over the next 6 months whether this is going to be a giant opportunity or we're going to shut the whole thing down. Okay, what does your boss say when you talk to that person about this? Oh, he doesn't listen to me at all because he says it's not important right now, but I know we're wasting money. Okay, we call that generally a good citizen effort. And with a 50-person engineering team, they're embezzling more than that in office supplies every month. So savings are not worth focusing on because it's not going to determine the success or failure of the project. Mm-hmm. If it hits and suddenly they have to scale up rapidly, then is the time to have that conversation. But I'll spin things up casually in my own AWS accounts and not worry terribly much about what it's costing in the short term. Now, I have monitoring and alerting that will tell me at some point when I cross certain thresholds,
right,
because you don't want to wind up with a terrifying surprise when you're especially a two-person business. But being able to understand that and, I guess, contextualize that is important. It gets way harder when it's no longer living in two people's heads, and instead you're talking about a 200-person org. No one is quite sure what other folks are necessarily doing in this.
Right.
It's the uncertainty. But as far as what they can think about when they're if someone's building something out, remember that data transfer is generally incomprehensible as far as tracking down. tagging is going to be important because someday you're going to want to know where the money's going. And that's one of the easiest ways to do it in an application or environment perspective. You're going to generally want to understand that things that are larger cost more than things that are smaller. Managed services, like the higher level things that involve endpoints, are going to have a per hour charge tied to them. I mean, a couple hundred bucks a month, not a big deal for most environments, but when you're a student in your dorm room somewhere, suddenly that's a massive problem.
Sure.
And understand the nuances. The worst part is that you look at the bill at the end of the month and you've gotten a surprise. It's the you should have known better, you dumbass feeling. And it's completely not true. None of this is intuitive. None of this is obvious. Mm-hmm. But the hard part is you can spend your entire career focusing on nothing other than the bill, which is apparently what I do now. And it's still... there's still going to be nuances. I still learn new things on virtually every engagement I'm on just because it's, I hadn't seen it applied in that particular direction before.
Right. Do you occasionally run into customers where you start going through things and generally speaking, you're like, this is pretty normal. This is good. Like, I think one of the advantages of being a consultant, because you do see a broad spectrum of projects, is just giving people a sense of what is normal and what is not normal.
Absolutely. And that the questions around that manifest themselves in a lot of different ways. There's always invariably a question about, okay, so this is our cost per user. How does that compare to our competitors?
Right.
Well, unless your competitors are public, they're not going to tell you that. And I either don't know, or if I do know, I can't tell you. So that's not really the metric to be looking at here. It's a question of effectively caring how these things reflect in the balance sheet and having a goal. We'd like to spend less. Okay, that's a decent enough goal. We'd like to spend 20% less. Okay, now that's a number and I can target that much more effectively. And we'd like to know what it is we're spending money on and what that's likely to do as we build out a model of unit economics for the future. Well, that's my wheelhouse. But being able to uncover all of that is not just a look at the bill, buy some RIs and call it good. That turns into nuanced discussions, into figuring out exactly what it is that a company does that makes sense. And getting a bunch of internal stakeholders aligned. I mean, one thing I do is I negotiate some of these large deals with AWS with my customers. Mm-hmm. The thing that not everyone seems to grasp up front is that those negotiations are often internal. Yes, they will wind up giving you another percentage point if you ask for it, but it might set you back 4 weeks or so. In the meantime, you can cut 10% off your bill by doing X, Y, and Z in that same period of time. Maybe start there. Or no, they're not going to give you a custom SLA because they can't agree to that. And what are you really depending on? The SLAs make you feel good, but is that going to wind up keeping your site up? When you're down, customers are going to be upset regardless of what SLA you've given them.
Yes.
As Charity Majors has famously said, nines don't matter if customers are unhappy.
Yeah, it's true. You can't going to make a customer happy with how good your nines are.
Exactly.
It also begs the question then, should we be getting to a place where we're able to break out the billing by the application?
Oh, absolutely. And the fact that we have to do a bunch of manual work to get there is one of the great failures of AWS's insights group, the mm-hmm. folks that handle all the billing and whatnot. I understand that it's complex. I understand that it's hard. I understand that it's incredibly difficult at that scale to do anything, let alone something this nuanced. But on the other hand, I'm not sure that I'm paying them a phone number in some cases to just solve the easy problems. And if you wind up getting a group of AWS folks in a room and talking to them, I mean, AWS customers, not employees, mm-hmm. and get them to start complaining. It doesn't matter if they've been doing it for 2 months or over a decade. Everyone goes back to the bill. It's one of the most painful parts of the entire experience. And the fact that it does not seem to have improved materially in the past decade is a failure that I lay directly at their feet. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to make individual people feel bad, and I'm not trying to call folks out, but customers are in pain here. What are you doing?
Why did you call the show Screaming in the Cloud?
Because originally I thought it'd be far more sarcastic, and it seemed to wind up fitting. I went through a bunch of different trial names, and naming things is incredibly hard.
Very hard.
One of the two hard problems in computer science. You've got naming things, cache invalidation, and off by one errors.
Right.
And at that point, it winds up just being something that's very hard to get right, especially when you don't know what something's going to become. You want something that's evocative, but not too clever, but you also don't want to constrain it artificially. Screaming in the Cloud speaks to a bunch of people at different providers, at different companies. It's not AWS specific. It's
right.
Cloud computing specific. Sure, AWS comes up a lot, but so do Azure, so does GCP. Mm-hmm. Oracle comes up approximately never because Oracle. And having conversations about what people are doing and where the next generation comes from is valuable. I would probably name it something different now, but you know, a year and a half in, that's going to be challenging.
Yeah, but you got other shows going too. So there's other names if people want other names for other things.
Exactly. If I want to get clever with naming, I can always just start continuing to play around with titles and episode headlines.
Yeah, well, your episode titles are hysterical. I've commented before.
Well, thank you.
You work way too hard on that. I worry about making sure the guest is in the title and the primary topic, preferably with a product name attached.
I'm sorry, the question once more?
There was no question there. I was being rhetorical.
There we go.
So what's next for you, friend?
That's a good question. I think more of the same. Chop wood, carry water, as the saying mm-hmm. goes. But it's the hard part for me when I'm doing the snarky analysis of things AWS has built out, and as reInvent continues to draw closer, the question always remains that there are a few constraints that I didn't realize when I started this. One is I want to be snarky, but I don't want someone who spent 18 months of doing blood, sweat, and tears to build this product and ship it to feel bad based upon the fact the first thing I do when it comes out is make fun of it.
Right.
So increasingly, I've started shifting to things like making fun of service names because no one spent 18 months worrying on what they're going to name this thing. And if they did, and something like systems manager, session managers, the best they could do in those 18 months, well, maybe they deserve to feel a little bit bad. But so I want to be snarky, but I don't want to wind up offending people. And I absolutely don't want to continue to be as derivative as it's easy to do. Like, oh, service comes out, I make fun of the name, rinse, repeat.
Yeah.
I want to continue to keep it fresh and interesting and exciting.
Yeah, no, that's always a challenge. So where can people find more about Corey Quinn?
Terrific question. Last week in AWS.com is where most of these things tend to live. I'm also on Twitter at QuinnyPig. That's QUINNYPIG. All one word.
Corey, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be had.
We'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.